Christianity is no different than any other religion. The record of history belies such a simple statement and makes it clear that most systems of faith, unlike Christianity, do not survive or thrive, but end up either dead or drastically altered. Social, theological, and historical pressures inevitably come to bear and force most religious faiths to either change with the times or cease to exist. The Impossible Faith offers an explosive proposition that Christianity, by the reckoning of men, ought to have been one of those faiths that either passed into history or became seriously altered. The ancient world did not share our modern values, and the social, religious, and philosophical conditions in which Christianity was founded and grew were antithetical in every conceivable way to its message. The arguments made in this book are so powerful that one atheist reader paid another atheist over $5,000 to write a response to them. Can you afford not to give them consideration? James Patrick Holding, The Impossible Faith, Why Christianity Succeeded When It Should Have Failed.
Breaking Unbelief, the podcast that challenges your mind. Welcome to the Breaking Unbelief podcast. This is Nick Daniels.
And I'm Tim Chafee. If you are interested in biblical topics and you're someone who likes to do research on the internet, then there's a good chance you've come across the name of today's guest. As you probably know, the internet has become a breeding ground for atheists and other critics and skeptics of the Bible. Because there is very little accountability and no peer review, a person can promote just about anything, any idea that they want, and it might gain some traction. Our guest today is J.P. Holding. He's the author of several books, including Shattering the Christ Myth and Trusting the New Testament. Today, he's here to talk about his book, The Impossible Faith. J.P., welcome to the Breaking Unbelief podcast.
Hey there. How you doing, Nick and Tim?
We're doing great. J.P., much of your work is conducted online, and you've become fairly well known as an apologist on the internet. When I Google your name, I notice that there's some J.P. Holding haters out there. Apparently, you've angered many of the so-called internet infidels. What have you done that caused so many of these people to despise what you do? And would you say that there's a difference between these kind of guys and some of the critical scholars like John Dominic Crossan?
What I've done, you could put it down to two different things. Number one, I'd pull no punches in loading down with answers and research, which many of them find it hard to cope with. And the other thing is I'm not afraid to let them know when I think they're doing an incompetent job of it. And I'll frequently tell them to their face, so to speak, that they are incompetent in what they're doing. And what you said about accountability is a very important issue related to this, because we've got so many people who think they know more than they do, posing themselves as experts. And at some point, we need to make it clear that these people are not experts, and we need to make that clear in the most clear way we can. Now, in terms of the differences between people like Crossan and others, there can be a difference in quality in many ways. But I find that there's two factors involved in this. There's being able to think logically and being able to have all the information at hand you need. And quite frankly, even someone like Crossan can be lacking in the logical department, even when he is straight on the factual department. But you have to be able to master both aspects of that in order to broker information successfully. And I find that usually my opponents are lacking in one or both of those areas.
Well, JP, the title of your book, the current book, is The Impossible Faith. Can you explain to our listeners what you mean by this term? What is an impossible faith?
Well, technically what I mean in that is that Christianity is a faith that could not possibly have arisen without some kind of intervention by God to have resurrected Jesus. In other words, there needs to be a sufficient explanation for why people became Christians. And in The Impossible Faith, I looked over several social factors of the New Testament world which would have made it impossible for a person of that era to believe in Christianity. And the only way they could have come to believe it, I would argue, is if they had evidence that Jesus rose from the dead.
JP, you mentioned in the book that an atheist once offered another atheist $5,000 to refute the claims that you make. First of all, why would an atheist pay anybody $5,000 to refute the claims? I mean, don't they consider themselves to be rational and they'll follow wherever the evidence leads? But also, did this person ever come up with a response, and what was it?
Okay. Well, it's a little bit of the history here. The person who paid the amount of $5,000 went online on the Theology Web forum as Johnny Skeptic, and he has been banned from there for quite some time now for his behavior. But he and I had some debate over these issues in impossible faith, and he became very frustrated at his inability to provide answers and to cope with some of the others on there who were debating him. And so one of his practices commonly was to write to other people, other scholars, and offer to pay them to respond to things that we were saying on there. And so he offered to pay $5,000 to Richard Carrier of Internet Infidels to write a response to my book. And so I would say that the reason that he did that is because he simply couldn't cope with the answers that we were giving him, and he needed someone to act as a surrogate. And that's why he, in particular, paid $5,000 to refute the claims.
And did Carrier come up with a response? And
he did
how
do
you
that,
think it stood
and
up?
I responded in turn, although Carrier tends not to want to admit that, I don't believe.
Well, in your book, you talk about honor as being an important concept in the Jewish culture of Jesus' day. How does this concept add to the idea of Christianity as being an impossible faith?
Well, let's explain what honor is, first of all. We're somewhat familiar with that concept in this society, but it was much more important to them in the ancient world and in many cultures today around the world. Honor essentially refers to what other people think of you, how they regard you. Now, we don't consider honor that important in many of our cultures in the American West, but in their culture, how others thought of you, what kind of honor rating you had was extremely important to them. It was as important to them as, you might say, paying the bills is to a modern American. Now, there are many factors associated with Christianity and honor that made it hard to believe, and the chief one that I talk about there is the crucifixion itself. Now, we look at the crucifixion, we think, oh, what a poor man, you know, crucified on a cross. And we tend to feel sorry for someone who's been executed, even if they happen to be a criminal. But if they happen to be innocent, then we especially feel sorry for them. But for those people, a crucifixion was a humiliating experience to go through. And the first thing that an ancient person would have said upon seeing Jesus on a cross was, well, he definitely deserved that. Or they would have thought that, you know, he had done something horrible, and therefore that he got what he deserved. And then you add the factor of trying to claim that he was the Son of God, that he was divinity. Their first thought was, no way that a God would put himself through that kind of thing. And so that's how I see honor factoring in as one example to Christianity being an impossible faith.
It's maybe something that we could relate to in modern times is maybe the Japanese culture, or you know, maybe the,
yes.
I don't know if you want to call it like the code of the samurai or something. You know, this honor being so important that if they lose that honor, they're willing to take their own life. Is that
correct?
All right. Well, one of your chapters also discusses the fact that Christianity should have never spread to the Roman world because Jesus already had three strikes against him. What are those three strikes, and why would this be a hindrance to the spreading of the gospel to the Roman world?
What you're talking about there is the three strikes Jesus had against him as a person alone, never mind as, say, the Son of God or as someone who is resurrected. Just as by reputation, coming as a teacher, these would be problems as well. There are three aspects to his identity that would have been problematic for the average Roman. The first was simply that he was Jewish. Now, among other Jews, that's not so much of a problem, but the Romans considered Judaism to be a superstition, to be a terrible thing. They would not have wanted to believe it wholesale. There were a few people who converted as God-fearers, accepting some of the moral aspects. But as a whole, you can look at authors like Tacitus from that era, and they have terrible things to say about the Jews. And so it would have been something that the average person would have said, what, you want me to believe in a Jewish teacher? No, I will not believe in someone who is Jewish. As they, it was anti-Semitism is what it amounted to, of the worst sort. They fought a war against Rome, of course, and they managed to almost fight them to a standstill, and for that reason Judaism was tolerated. But the Romans would have preferred to do without it, quite frankly. Now, the second strike against Jesus has to do with the fact that he was from Galilee. And let me just sum that up very simply. That would be like saying that someone today was from Afghanistan. They associated that place, Galilee, with people who were warmongers. And then you add the fact that Jesus was crucified, which is the death associated with those who were rebels against the Roman state, then automatically I think it would be, oh, he's from Galilee. He must have been preaching sedition of some kind, and that must be why he was executed. And the last aspect I refer to there is that he was from Nazareth. And why Nazareth in particular? Because it was a small town. And as today, there is very much a prejudice against people from small towns frequently. It's just you're considered to not be that honorable of a person or that important of a person. In fact, if you try to make yourself seem important, you would be looked upon as rising above yourself. And that would incur even more problems. So So those three aspects of Jesus as a person would have been a serious hindrance to spreading the gospel, because you would have to deal right away with just his identity. And why should we listen to someone like this from places like this?
Well, another difficulty that you talk about, that the followers of Jesus would have had to overcome, was that they were proclaiming that Jesus rose from the dead in bodily form. Now, that I don't know if that would be so much a problem for the Jews, but for the Greeks or the Roman world, that certainly would have been problematic, wouldn't it?
It would have been a problem for both in a different way. I'll explain each one. Now, in terms of the Jews, yeah, they had no problem with bodily resurrection in and of itself as a process. But the problem that Christians would have had in proclaiming their faith is that resurrections were not expected to occur until the very end of the age, when God came back and judged everybody. Now, to say that a single person was raised like that far ahead of the general resurrection of all men, you would have had to have some kind of explanation for that. Why was Jesus so special? As far as the Gentiles, though, there was a greater difficulty, and that's that they rejected the whole idea of resurrection pretty much entirely, because they believed that matter fairly much was evil. And like, their thought was, well, why in the world would you want to keep your body? It's such a horrible thing. And so one of the ways that the emperors were seen as being released from life was through a process called apotheosis. That's simply where their spirit rose into heaven, and they left the body behind. And also, as well, cremation was a very popular way to dispose of your body, because they figured, well, you don't need it anymore, and you don't want it anymore, because we don't want to be bound in that form. And so it's not something that they would have considered a desirable way to end up. Resurrection was something they rejected, and they would have rejected it as something that Jesus went through as well, for the same reason.
And you also mentioned that Christianity contained many teachings that ran counter to the societal norms of Jesus' day, especially when Jesus talked about forsaking one's own family or the fact that he allowed tax collectors and women to sit on his teachings. How would this contribute to the thesis that Christianity was an impossible faith?
Oh, without going over a list of each of the potential teachings, let's just sum it up generally by saying that there were certain values that were considered normal and proper for that day, and many of Jesus' teachings simply undermined those or considered them less important than he was. Let's just take one of the more prominent examples. We remember where Jesus told the man who said, well, I'm going to follow you, but first let me go bury my father, and I'll be right back. And Jesus said, well, no, you can, the dead can bury their own dead. You just come and follow me. Now, showing respect for your parents like that, and whether the man actually was dead or not, that's an open question. But showing respect for your parents by giving them burial like that was considered a high priority. It was considered part of honoring your father and mother. So what you're having Jesus essentially saying here is, I'm more important than one of the Ten Commandments. And that following me is much more important than that. Just leave your father to be buried by someone else. Follow me right now. And just consider how offensive that would sound even today. You know, I'm going to a memorial service today for someone. Can you imagine how offensive it would be to go up to a family member and say, oh, no, don't bother burying that person. We got something else to do over here. And that's offensive today. And you can imagine how much more offensive it was to them in a culture where you were supposed to honor your parents so highly.
Oh, that's a great point. Well, so maybe it is unlikely that Christianity would have spread in the environment from which it started. And sometimes maybe the skeptics will grant you that. But other religions, in your book, you have a chapter where you investigate three different religions, Mithraism, Mormonism, and Islam, to see if they meet these requirements of an impossible faith. Now, we don't have time in the interview to cover all three, but your book does. Can you tell us why, let's just pick one of them, like Mormonism. Why doesn't Mormonism qualify as an impossible faith?
Yeah, I examined each of those three in the particulars that I discussed. And for Mormonism in particular, there are a couple of things. Just running over the examples I gave, well, Joseph Smith didn't die a shameful death. In fact, if you investigate the way he died fighting back, essentially. And he also had a lot of people supporting him in what he was trying to do, and not just always against him. Mormonism also grew up in America at a time when people were starting to be more concerned with each other as individuals rather than as groups, and where things like honor were not so much of a concern. It's interesting to note, for example, that when it came to polygamy, one of the defenses that the Mormons used at that time against those who were persecuting them because of it was, well, stay away from us, hands off, that's none of your business. Now, that kind of response would never have worked in the Roman Empire, because the state considered it its business to go around quashing deviant groups, such as the Mormons would have been. Of course, even in American history, you know, the American government did try and squash the Mormons to a certain extent. But when they went out into Utah, they were pretty much left alone. You know, as long as they got out of the way and didn't bother anybody, there was a certain feeling that, well, let's just leave them to their own devices, although eventually they did give up polygamy. That in itself is another reason why Mormonism doesn't qualify as an impossible faith, because they were so ready to give up an important doctrine in the face of persecution, whereas Christianity did not do that in that early first century period. The only people who gave that up were some of the heretics, such as the Docetists, who gave up the doctrine of the resurrection. And now there's many other more detailed factors we could go into, but you know, my finding for all three of those, and I chose them as the most significant candidates that could be examined, show that they were not afflicted by any of the factors that caused Christianity to be an impossible faith.
Well, you also talk about evangelism. What are the pillars of early evangelism, and how did this support your claims?
What I had to do as a corollary to this thesis is decide what is it that the apostles would appeal to as evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Because obviously, if I'm saying only the resurrection could prove to people that Christianity was true, I had to come up with what sort of evidence they would use to show that it was true. And so here's what I came up as the pillars of early evangelism. The first thing was, in general, miracles, wonders, and signs, whether done by Jesus during his ministry or done by the apostles after Jesus ascended into heaven. And also, relatedly, they might appeal to things like the darkness at the time of the crucifixion or the various signs in the temple, like the curtain being torn. The second thing they would appeal to is, of course, the empty tomb, which is what we still appeal to today in our apologetics arguments. You know, that's the chief evidence that Jesus was resurrected. He's no longer in the tomb. And the last thing they would appeal to is the way Jesus fulfilled Old Testament prophecy. Now, there's a bit of a misunderstanding here very commonly, which is that when someone like Isaiah spoke, you know, Isaiah 7:14 spoke of a virgin with child, that he was in some way predicting there will be a virgin with child at some point in the future. Rather, the way Isaiah saw it is he was predicting a certain event in his time, but in the New Testament era, people looked at that and said, God is repeating history in a new way, and he is thereby fulfilling this verse, not as a prediction, but as a pattern. And so they would find it necessary to appeal to these Old Testament patterns being repeated in order to show that Christianity was true. And so between those three pillars, miracles in general, the empty tomb, and Old Testament prophecy being fulfilled, these are the evidences that would be appealed to by the apostles and by the early Christians to convince people to become Christians.
Talking about the evidence of Christianity then as a faith, that wouldn't be impossible, is the resurrection. And some skeptics like to claim that the apostles wanted to believe in the resurrection so badly that, I mean, eventually they just convinced themselves that it happened. What will you say about this?
Well, there's a couple of problems with it. Let me just highlight the most important, which is that the resurrection, believing in Jesus being resurrected, was not the option that was open to them ideologically if they had some problem with Jesus being killed. Because of that belief I alluded to earlier about resurrections not occurring until the end of time, if they had had some sort of wish fulfillment problem, what they would have come up with, rather than Jesus being resurrected, is rather Jesus' body ascending into heaven. In fact, what I show is that the apostles believed that if anything was going to happen, that's what would have happened. Jesus' body would have been taken into heaven, such as Moses' body had been in the apocryphal literature, or like Elijah had been taken into heaven. They were not expecting a resurrection. And so one of the most critical aspects of this, which is sometimes related to the hallucination thesis, for example, is that whatever they wanted so badly would, in their imagination, come to pass, you know, that they believed it actually happened. But it had to be something that they would expect to happen. But since they were not expecting a resurrection, there's no way they could have dreamed up this idea. And so there's no way it can be claimed that they wanted it so badly, because that's not what they would have been wanting in the first place.
All right. Well, you know, there's many other arguments that the skeptics use. Sometimes they like to claim that Jesus never really died on the cross, you know, maybe the swoon theory, and then he just revived in the tomb. Is this a viable alternative?
No, absolutely not. That's one of the most amusing of all. And, you know, there have been appeals by people like Carrier to people who have been like thought to be dead but really weren't, and then they were revived but in some way, like they were given CPR or what have you, or they were awakened up when they had a coroner taking pictures of them thinking they were dead, and then they were awakened up by the flash from the camera. And there's really no comparison to this. There's no comparison to that kind of thing for the kind of treatment that Jesus underwent. And whatever you may think of the movie The Passion, it was a reasonably accurate rendition of what happened in that time with to a crucifixion victim. And there's no way that you can appeal to that. I've spoken to an emergency medical doctor about this issue, and he just completely waves away this idea like that Jesus was given some kind of drug on the cross, or that he could have survived inside a tomb that was very cold and that he was shivering, had not been given food and water for hours on end, lost a great amount of blood. And it takes a lot of imagination to believe in a thesis like that.
Yeah, typically we don't put people in a cold, dark, damp place when we want them to recuperate from a beating or something like that. Oh, go ahead.
I've been watching Dr. G Medical Examiner a lot. I think she'd have a lot of fun with the idea.
Well, perhaps my favorite skeptical view is that someone stole Jesus' body. You know, that was the first argument back in Matthew. You know, tell people that the disciples came and stole the body while we were sleeping. How would you respond to somebody who makes this kind of a claim?
Well, you're right. That is the classic appeal, and has been since Matthew's day. And really, the answer has been basically the same: is that there's too much risk involved for the disciples in stealing the body. And, too much of a moral conundrum in saying that they would steal it and then proclaim the resurrection. Both the risk and the moral aspect of that was something that was beyond what they could withstand, because they would be under considerable pressure as deviants from the norm to somehow break and say, well, yes, we did steal the body, or yes, we were complicit in this whole thing. Jesus did not really rise from the dead. The price that they would have had to pay for that was simply not worth it. And it would have been so much easier to say something like, oh, well, Jesus had an apotheosis of some kind, or something equivalent to that in a Jewish belief, or to simply go on preaching without any respect to Jesus, to just make him out as a martyr of some kind, as a great moral teacher. And so, why would they bother to do this? Why pay the price when there's so much simpler things that they could have done? And, of course, they would have been suspected from the very beginning and hounded endlessly at every stop. And there's another thing as well about the preaching. And because when they went into any area and started preaching, they were strangers. And strangers were considered very suspicious at that time. If you were from outside, well, you were going to be questioned back and forth. You were going to be given the third degree. And so there's so much pressure that would have been on them trying to steal the body. Now, of course, the disciples are the primary suspects, and there's a couple of others suggested, like the authorities, it might have been. But I'll tell you, that's pretty easy, of course, because they would have simply said, no, we took it, and that would have been the end of it, or at least started a debate, what we have seen till today. But I think my favorite one of all is this idea that Carrier came up with in particular, that Jesus' body was stolen by these mysterious traveling necromancers who needed Jesus' body to perform magical spells.
And there's a lot of evidence for that one, right?
Well, there's plenty of evidence for that kind of person in Palestine. But see, I checked into some of these claims that Carrier made and some of these texts that he cited, and I just found, for example, this was the funniest one of all. When these grave robbers went into a tomb, they never stole the entire body. They either left the body where it was and, performed the rite that they were doing right there in the tomb, or they might cut off, some part of the body to perform the spell. And so I'm thinking, this necromancer went in there, cut off Jesus' nose, and left. And so the gospel message from there on would be, his nose is risen. I don't think that's going to work too well.
Right. And of course, the major problem with disciples stealing the body is they all died a martyr's death, with the exception of John. And while it's true that some people might be willing to die for a lie, they're not going to die for something that they know is a lie. And I think that refutes that whole notion.
Well, there is a point to that, but I tell you, I don't think they even had to die for it to be a serious problem for them. The amount of persecution socially they would have undergone would have made the price just as heavy, if not heavier, to them. Because, you made a comparison to Japanese culture. They're willing to die often when they're shamed. So it's even worse for them sometimes to be left alive and persecuted and shamed.
Hmm.
Right. Well, you have two new books also, besides The Impossible Faith. They're called Chariot the Christ Myth and Trust in the New Testament. Can you tell our listeners a little about these books?
Well, Shattering the Christ Myth was designed as an all-purpose refutation of the idea that Jesus did not exist, which is sometimes called the Christ Myth. And I got together a team of contributors who helped me write some of the chapters. And there are also updates of chapters from my website on some of the secular sources about Jesus and refutations of some of the major Christ Myth proponents like Earl Doherty and Akira S., otherwise known as Dorothy Murdoch. Now, trust in the New Testament is somewhat newer, and that's about the reliability of the New Testament transmission process, not about the historicity of the events recorded in it, but about textual criticism, like how reliably the text was transmitted to us, how reliable oral tradition was in that particular day and time, how the canon was formed, and also about the authorship of the New Testament documents, whether or not we can make a good case for their authorship according to the ascriptions we have. And I'm working right now on a more detailed defense of the resurrection, which will amplify what I've written in the Impossible Faith book. It'll include answers to some of the criticisms that levied against the Impossible Faith.
Well, JP, where can our listeners find out more about your ministry?
Well, the place to go is Tecton Apologetics Ministries, and the website address on that is tektonics.org. And remember to make that a .org because a .com will bring you to an engineering firm in Virginia, and they don't want to talk to you about Jesus.
Or about J.P. Holding, I'm sure. Well,
No,
the
they
name of
have
the
no idea who I am, hopefully.
no. The name of the book is The Impossible Faith. It's a fairly quick read, but it takes a fresh look at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ by touching on some of the issues that are rarely discussed. JP, thank you so much for joining us today on Breaking Unbelief.
Thank you very much for having me. Talk to you again sometime soon.
The Impossible Faith. Well, that's a provocative title, one that could lead you both ways. Is it good or bad that Christianity is an impossible faith? But of course, you know, Tim, what JP is trying to convey is that Christianity could be an impossible faith, would be an impossible faith, unless it was true, unless Jesus actually rose from the dead. So I think in that sense, it's a good thing, an argument for the truth of the Christian faith.
Well, Nick, I completely agree. It is a good thing that it's an impossible faith in the way that JP talks about it. I liked how he focused on some of the lesser-known facts about the resurrection. Many people know about the more popular arguments, such as the empty tomb, the post-resurrection appearances, and the changes in the disciples' behavior. These guys went from fleeing on the night that Jesus was arrested to just several weeks later boldly proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But JP brought up some other details that many people don't even think about. Maybe they don't even know about. For example, the resurrection, that the message of the resurrection was contrary to what both Jews and Greeks thought. Many Jews, except for the Sadducees, of course, believed in a bodily resurrection, but that was supposed to occur at the end of time. So the idea that one man would be raised to life before everybody else was contrary to their expectations. And many Greeks viewed the idea of bodily resurrection with disgust. For them, the body was evil and it needed to be done away with. So for early Christians to proclaim a bodily resurrection would have sounded like foolishness to the Greeks. And then he also talked about things like Jesus having three strikes against him. He was a Jewish guy. He was from Galilee, and not just Galilee, but he was from Nazareth. And so all of these things would have made it much more difficult for the Christians to proclaim their message. Yet, in spite of all these inherent difficulties, Christianity grew and flourished. So, Nick, why don't you tell our listeners about our next episode?
Sure. Our next episode we'll be talking about the debate on the age of the earth. Is it millions of years or just thousands of years old? We'll talk about the origins of these ideas and what the Bible has to say about it.
Please be sure to check out our website at www.breakingunbelief.org and visit our Facebook fan page. And also, please listen to our previous episodes, which cover a variety of important issues. We hope you join us next week. Goodbye.